This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A good friend of mine who's a curator told me I ought to talk to June Wayne when she came to town. I didn't know who Wayne was. She's not very well known outside the art world. I learned she's considered to be the artist most responsible for the American revival of the form of printmaking known as lithography. And she's a woman who had to defy conventions personally and professionally to remain an artist. Wayne was born in 1918 and had her first solo gallery show before she turned 20. She started off as a painter. When she began making prints in the 1940s, she realized there were virtually no master printers left in the United States. She had to rely on commercial printers who treated her lithos as if they were restaurant menus. In 1960, she received a Ford Foundation grant to start the Tamarind Lithography Workshop, which she directed for a decade. The workshop, based in California, trained master printers and succeeded in reviving the dying form. Wayne continues to work in her own California studio. She's in Philadelphia to give the commencement addresses at the Moore College of Art and Design and the School of the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts. I asked Wayne how the creation of the Tamarind Lithography Workshop helped her as an artist.
It hurt me as an artist.
Oh.
Because when I organized Tamarind, I was one of the few artists in this country who was any good at it. So I was in the catbird seat. I was doing what the French call raising foxes to eat my chickens. My role in relation to Tamarind has not been seen, I think, in its proper dimension. I conceptualized it, invented it, brought people together, etc. Had I been a man, there would have been nothing unusual about being a leader and being credited as such. But for many, many years, it was assumed, A, that I was an administrator or a teacher, not somebody who could philosophize and then lead a movement. And of course, having founded it in 1960, that was the time when women behaved themselves. Remember, we were just out of the McCarthy period. It was a very conservative time in its mindset. So that the assumption, the general assumption was, that to have received all this money from the Ford Foundation, obviously I must have earned it on my back, or that there was some male who really was doing the work. And it's only in recent, the last few years, that I have retaken my own history by reframing, as I'm doing at this moment, the nature of my role. For me, Tamarind was a work of conceptual art. And as I am accustomed to working in many media, not just lithography, that seemed perfectly natural for me to do.
Let me ask you, when you felt that people were making the assumption that, oh, you were a teacher or administrator, but not an artist, not a philosophizer, not a leader, and when people assumed that, oh, she got to the stature on her back or something like that, they wouldn't just come out and say that to you. So how do you pick up on that? What were the cues that you picked up on?
It's surprising how often you do hear what people say. Sometimes people would just say it, or say it without realizing they were saying it. If I was speaking publicly, they would refer to me. I might be introduced as a teacher, which I have never been, or the executive secretary of, or the administrator of, that kind of thing. So those were direct. There was common, I had a nickname, TBIC.
What's that?
That bitch in California.
Oh, dear. Who nicknamed you that?
Well, I know where it came from. I thought it was rather funny to think that I could have so much resonance all the way from Los Angeles, which was considered to be the outback, you know, in the 60s.
For the visual arts.
Yeah.
Yeah. Who nicknamed you that?
I'm not going to mention names, but it traveled all over the world.
Uh-huh.
And it was, so there was that. But then there are all the other cues by which women are received or perceived And since I'm the daughter of a feminist, I was tuned to those as well because they were realities with which I had to cope. You can't cope with them by head-on collision if you're going to get anywhere. But you have to be able to flow around them or even cater to prejudice in order to continue on a constructive path.
My guest is artist June Wayne. You say that your mother was a feminist. Mm-hmm. In what respect was she a feminist?
Well, she was a she was a feminist and pacifist. She was also a working woman.
Mm-hmm.
She was a traveling saleswoman in the corset industry. And she never found it odd that although she believed in women's rights, she was selling a kind of garment that oppressed women in the name of style. She used to say to me, however, June, if you're wearing the right panty girdle, you can never be raped.
Really?
Yeah.
What was the logic behind that?
Well, the logic was that a panty girdle in those days was a formidable garment, and she felt impenetrable as well. But so that...
gee, that's great. Panty girdle as self-defense.
Yeah. Well, you know, those corsets
right.
full of whalebone
yeah.
and power net elastic and so on were very hard to get in and out of under the best of circumstances, let alone if you were also fighting. So she viewed what she was doing not just as a fulfillment of women's proper image, you know, being put together properly, but also as a sort of defense against aggressors, inviting an aggressor and rejecting him as well.
So did you wear corsets when you were a teenager?
No. She used to send them to me in California. She lived in Chicago. And these small castles would arrive. You know, they were medieval. And I would put them carefully in a drawer. But I always wore those tiny little two-way stretch girdles that you could buy for 99 cents. And when she'd come out, she'd open the drawer, look at all this very expensive lingerie that she had sent me. And she'd say, "You're taking the bread right out of my mouth."
So she wore them, I take it.
Oh, of course. She believed they were good for your health, and it kept things and parts from falling out, as it were.
How are they good for your health?
Don't ask.
Right.
That was the prevailing belief, you know. And when she was a girl, she was a secretary, one of the secretaries to Bernard McFadden.
Who was?
He was the original health nut.
Oh.
And he was also the founder of Cosmopolitan.
Oh.
A Popular Mechanics, Red Book. He was a great publisher of popular magazines, all kinds of them. But he had an Encyclopedia of Physical Health, in which is really worth your time to look into. It was so funny. So Dorothy, who thought he was very funny, nonetheless picked up many of his views about physical culture.
Dorothy was your mother?
Yeah.
Do you have any of these corsets as souvenirs,
yes,
as mementos?
Yes, I did a suite of prints that are a biography of Dorothy, like her history in 20 freeze frames, coming out of the original material letters, documents, and of course, drawings of her. And one is called Secretary to a Publisher, in which she sits in front of a very large page out of the McFadden Encyclopedia of Health, including several quotes. But also in it, I include one print of her best-selling brassiere. And then I did a little suite, an ancillary suite, called Next of Skin, of a merry widow. Do you remember those? Bustier, they call them now. Several brassieres, one of those two-way panty stretches that she sold. And then I did two jock straps as well. Jock for sport, with the design of Adidas sports stripes. And the other one called Jock for Cocktails, of a silk, dark green with black elastic dressy jock strap, rampant on a lionskin field, and with little unicorns running through the fabric. I tried to balance out the lingerie of men and women.
I'm always interested in people who call their parents by their parents' first name. How come you call your mother Dorothy?
Two reasons. One is that I saw her as a separate individual.
Besides mother.
Yes. I didn't define her in terms of being my daughter. For one thing, she was, in effect, the father of our little family. We were three women, my grandmother, my mother, and I. My mother was divorced when I was an infant, and my grandmother was widowed early. So that our roles as a family were defined in a different way than in a nuclear family. And that was very helpful to me because she really broke with my father, and I never had to choose between warring parents. Now, she went out and earned the living. My grandmother took care of the house and raised me, as it were, and I was expected to look, you know, to carry my share. So that by the time I was 15, I was already working, and I left home close to 16 and supported myself from then on. So it was possible, you see, to see Dorothy as a member of the household, almost like a sister.
Mm-hmm.
And our relationship from then on was as one person to another. And she had quite a different profile of interests than I did. She used to say to me, "I'll never understand you, but I guess it's all right."
My guest is artist and printmaker June Wayne. She's credited with reviving the art of lithography in America. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Artist June Wayne is my guest. Coming from a pretty unconventional family and from a pretty feminist family, what was your mother's and grandmother's reaction to you wanting to be an artist?
You must understand that the stereotype of a girl when I was a girl was that doing handicrafts and making things pretty was fine. To be a girl was actually an asset if you said you wanted to be an artist. A young boy would have been straightened out at once because he had to support a family, right? Or else he might be a sissy. But the crunch would come when you were older and you still wanted to be an artist. At that point, a boy would be taken seriously and a girl would be expected to make watercolors on the dining room table while the kiddies were sleeping and choose the right chintz for bedspreads and curtains, you see. So there was that warp in perception of boys and girls and of men and women, and that perception has been strengthened in recent years. Certainly,
you think so?
Oh, yes. I think women have lost a lot of territory in recent years as compared to the gains we made in the 70s.
So was there a point in your life where you felt that the pressure was for you to get married, have children, and paint pretty watercolors?
Oh, yes. I think the 50s, the 40s and the 50s, we were very much defined and by the idea that you would be somebody's wife and that if you were a mother, you were a certain kind of a mother, and that came first. And so it was a very difficult stereotype for me to break out of.
Did you ever marry or have
Yes,
children?
I did. And I have a daughter. But I organized my life and often with great difficulty to try to fulfill both roles. My daughter was in college before she realized, really, that she knew I was an artist, but before she really realized who I was. She came home from school one day and she said, "We were reading in a book about an artist named June Wayne. Is that you?" I said, "Yes." She said, "Why didn't you tell me?" And I said, "Suppose I had, would it have made any difference to you?" And there was a long pause and she said, "I guess not."
You actually hid from her that you were an artist?
It isn't that I hid from her, but that I fulfilled my responsibilities that as they affected her, but also bought my own time to be who I was. In that sense, I lived two lives, and I learned a variety of ways how to use my time so effectively that I could buy pieces of it. For example, I used to work all night, and I learned to do with very little sleep, or to sleep in snatches so that I could then do what I wanted to do. But the time, by the time she was 12 or 13, I really split out of that completely.
Can I ask you how seriously your husband took your work?
He thought it was very, at that time, that husband, thought it was all very nice as long as it didn't get in his way.
Did it?
Oh, yes, it did, in many ways. And it was difficult. I think it was difficult for him, but it was impossible for me.
How so?
Well, because one is what one is, particularly someone as deeply an artist as I am. I mean, that's, when I was a child and people said, "Hello, little girl, who are you?" And I'd say, I wouldn't give my name. I'd say, "I'm an artist." And it's very important to be able to accept yourself. And as an artist, you have to do that, because if you're any good, the art world, most of the time, will disapprove of you, even the art world. If you're any good, you're ahead of it, you see.
Mm-hmm. Was there a turning point in your life when you went from trying to pretend, even to your daughter or to the rest of the world, that you weren't an artist and that you were fulfilling your function as a wife and mother and woman in society? We went from that to saying, well, I am what I am. I'm an artist, and I'm not going to have to stay up all night and not sleep anymore in order to be able to be a wife, mother, and artist.
Well, I never defined myself as wife and mother,
mm-hmm.
So that wasn't too difficult. But I did split in the 50s. I left home, my daughter, my then husband, and I went off to Europe, and I really thought I might never come back. It was just too much. And from then on, I never went back into that cage.
It must have been really something for you to leave your daughter especially.
Yes.
How old was she?
Well, she was in her early teens. And it isn't as though she wasn't provided for. But the point is that teenagers are really adults already. We pretend they're not, but we forget that only in recent time have we babied children so long, keeping them out of the labor market, keeping them in school for years and years and years, when they are not only at their peak, but in the case of boys, are rapidly over the hill by the time they're 18.
What kind of guilt, and I'm making an assumption here that you felt guilt, but I don't, I'm sure you did. What kind of feelings did you have to overcome to make that decision to leave?
I must say that I had less of a struggle with that than others, because from the kind of vantage point that I had all my life, and with the kinds of kind of role model that my mother represented, she wasn't fully out by any means, out in the sense of being unconventional from the outside. But I knew from the time I was a very little girl that there were nuclear families, and then there were other families, and that they lived side by side. And so I never felt that I had to conform to what other people thought. And I must tell you now that my view is, if it doesn't amuse me, and it doesn't educate me. To hell with it.
Do you and your daughter ever talk about that decision you made years ago to go to Europe? I wonder what her reaction is to it now as an adult herself.
Well, I couldn't possibly speak for her.
Yeah.
I wouldn't try to.
Did you ever get close again afterwards?
Oh, yes. We see each other almost every day. It isn't that. I think that for everybody around you, being straight out is the best way. You get all that stuff out of the way, and then you can make connections to people because they know who you are, and you know who they are, and you take the good with the bad, and get on with your life, which is very short, after all.
Do you feel that you've become a mother figure in a lot of ways to younger women artists over the years? Because there haven't been a lot of women for younger women to use as role models.
Well, I don't much care for role models.
Mm-hmm.
And I disclaim that position. If a young artist or a young woman or anybody wishes to learn from what's available or to follow a particular course of action which that someone else has taken and that seems to have worked for them, fine. That's fine. But if you have to find a role model in order to make your way in life, you're in deep trouble because each of us is obliged to swim alone in that sense. You have to draw on what you are. And you have to watch to see what kind of water you're swimming in.
June Wayne, I thank you very much for talking with us.
Sure.
Artist June Wayne is in Philadelphia to give the commencement addresses at the Moore College of Art and Design and the School of the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.